Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe.
I almost forgot to unmute myself. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the October 10th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. And this is a special show because this is the first episode in the second year of Pub Talk Live. So I've officially been doing it for a year. So thank you all for joining us for this one. I'm your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, a board member, an agent liaison for Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so you don't miss a show if you'd like. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description as well. So I, hi everyone. Hey Jay. So if this is your first time joining us, the kind of regulars around here, they call themselves pubbers. And so welcome pubbers, and also welcome to, future pubbers. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce today's guest co-host. Sandra Mitchell has been a phone psychic, a car salesperson, a denture deliverer, and a layout waxer. She's dodged trains, endured basic training, and hitchhiked from Montana to California. The author of nearly 20 books for tweens and teens, Mitchell's work includes Edgar nominee Shadowed Summer, the Vespertine series, Lambda finalist and IAA winner, All the Things We Do in the Dark, and the Camp Murder Face series with Josh Burke. She's also the editor of three anthologies for teens, Defy the Dark, All Out, and Out Now. She always picks truth. Dares are too easy. So please welcome to the show, Sandra Mitchell. Hi.
I promise I won't keep the mask on the entire time. I have a cough, and so sometimes putting it on soothes it, makes my tones more dulcet.
Gotcha. All right. A lot of people are just wearing masks all the time, so I don't even question it anymore.
I've gotten used to it. I like the humidity when I breathe it back in.
Huh. Oh yeah, I can see that.
I find it pleasant.
Sure. Yeah. I live in Florida, so it's always humid when I breathe. So.
Oh yeah, you don't need a mask for that then.
Yeah. So you I just want to ask you real quick about hitchhiking from Montana to California. What? I guess my first question is why?
Okay. So way back in the beginning of the internet, when it was still all black and white and Usenet and things like that. and when everybody that was on the internet was an axe murderer, I had made a bunch of friends on the internet, and I decided that I was going to take a train trip out west so that I could meet my internet friends. And I got to the first stop and I met my friend Shroud. We all met in Alt Vampires, by the way.
Okay.
And while I was visiting, their girlfriend broke up with them. And so suddenly they found themselves homeless. And so I was like, well, I'm going to visit our friends because we all met like in the same place. And they were like, but I don't have the money for a train ticket. So I got the brilliant idea, the kind of brilliant idea you only have when you're like 22 and really inadvisedly brave.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why don't we hitchhike?
Yeah.
And so that indeed is what we did. And we discovered that if Mormon kids or little kids were in charge of the car, we would have been to Los Angeles like in 2 days flat.
All right, that's I remember my papaw talking a lot about hitchhiking when he was younger. He was in the military though, that like a lot of military guys, especially when they came back from the war, that's like what they did. That's how they got places, right? Yeah.
Now see, Shroud and I had both served in the military, so ironically enough, or it's not actual irony, it's Alanis Morissette irony. We both had our military duffels when we were hiking together. But really, I wouldn't have done it by myself. I felt much safer with a friend, which in retrospect is super dumb, but it worked out. It worked out. I ended up bringing Shroud home to Indiana with me, and now we've been married 25 years this year.
Oh my gosh. That story ended very differently than I expected. Yes.
Yeah, nobody got axe murdered.
Wow, that's so cool.
We didn't even meet a chainsaw murderer. It was, you know, very wild trip.
I mean, that you know of.
Well, true. It could have happened behind us.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and get started with today's show. If you haven't voted in the viewer poll yet, I'm going to drop that link in the discussion so you can go and vote there. And it's a pretty simple question. What time of the day do you tend to write best? And we'll talk about that and the results at the end of the show. And then we're just going to jump right into news items. We got an interesting mix today, and Sandra has our first item.
We do. Best-selling authors and married couple Nicola and David Yoon announced last week that they'll be launching a new imprint at Random House. Joy Revolution will debut in 2022 and is devoted to publishing YA love stories by and about people of color.
Yeah.
It's nice to... I love that Lee and Lowe and Two Books are all out there doing that. And I love that it's spreading. Because, you know, the less niche these stories become, the more, the much happier I think that the entire landscape for teens and tweens reading is going to be.
Mm. Yeah. And I love, especially this announcement struck me, like there have been a lot, or I wouldn't say a lot, but there's been a couple of these announcements that I may not have included in news items, but I just thought it was really cool as Nicola and David Yoon, who are married and both authors. And it's just like, I don't know. It's good to have good news sometimes.
It is. It really is good to have good news. Excuse me. I also love the fact that, I love Nicola's books. And so like when she says is like, we're going to have, you know, love stories. I'm like, yeah, because I know they're going to be good love stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. So keep an eye out for those in 2022, which seems like a long time, but in publishing, that's nothing. okay, so the next, we have another piece of good news. So we talked about last week, Macmillan made an announcement that they were raising their starting salary. And so following that announcement, independent publisher Beacon Press announced it was raising its minimum salary by $9,000 to $44,600 starting this month. They also adjusted other salaries throughout the company. And we talked last episode about kind of this issue with starting salaries and publishing, and how it keeps a lot of people out who don't have, you know, the financial means to, oh my gosh, a cat. I'm at my sister's house and she has a new cat and it just like meowed at me.
Oh, I thought my cat escaped and was in the background.
No, she's definitely outside my door. So funny. She's a little baby kitty. She's like, 4 pounds, 3 pounds, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. So we were talking last episode. The Macmillan, it was 42,000 is their minimum now, which I had looked up as a comparison salary in my city in Orlando would be less than 25,000. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people, they'll see this number and they'll think, oh, that's a pretty good starting salary. But then when you consider the cost of living in New York City,
right. It's, my question was tough.
Uh-oh, I think you froze a little bit.
Bounced, which is fantastic. I mean, don't get me wrong, that's absolutely fantastic. But based on like conversations with my agents and with other author friends who live like in New York where publishing is, that's not even a living wage, is it? Like you're still going to have a roommate at $44,000 if mm-hmm. you want to actually live anywhere near the city.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's weird because we're like, oh, they raised it 9,000. So, you know, that's what they raised it by 20%. No, because it was originally 35. So they raised it by almost 30% basically. Mm-hmm. And we're still like, oh, that's, you still can't really live on that.
You know, issues of parity like that are really important to me because I grew up dirt poor. I grew up in government housing. You know, the reason I joined the military was because I was hoping that I could get the GI Bill. You know, there was no way that I was going to go to college without assistance. And so I have found through my career that occasionally, like, I will write something about, it's not even necessarily like a super poor character, but it's definitely not like, you know, a New York City standard of living kind of character. And I've had editors who are like, really? Is that accurate? I don't, mm-hmm. It's like, they don't believe in, you know, upper, lower class, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, it's a great step in the right direction. So yeah, I don't want to be like, oh, that sucks. You
know? Yeah. It's just, it's a really difficult thing in our industry. And yeah, I know a lot of people who started in publishing in New York City who said they wouldn't have been able to do it without either financial support from their family or even just, like, you know, somewhere to live from their family or
right.
spouses or anything like that. So,
yeah, like internships, you know, that's a whole separate thing.
Yeah. But,
you know, internships are basically, you know, you're going to get people who are wealthy enough to not have a job in New York City in your internships. And that does not include, you know, a huge swath of the population.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely doesn't include someone like me.
Me either. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have some more good news that I was excited to hear about.
I'm excited about this. And actually, like, you know, even though it's not about the money, I'm still like, I'm so glad that there's money with this. The MacArthur Foundation announced its 2020 fellows, also known as the Mark MacArthur Genius Grants. There were some familiar names on that list, including authors N.K. Jemisin and Jacqueline Woodson, which is, they're both so awesome. And one person that I want to add is Tressie McMillan Cottom, who is, she's in academia, and she speaks on all of these parity issues and on, you know, like, she's been one of the very forward voices on Black Lives Matters and white privilege. And I just love that, you know, these three ladies are getting such a fantastic opportunity to spread out their audience and to spread out their message.
Yeah. I had included N.K. Jemisin and Jacqueline Woodson in the little wrap up because I talk about them a lot on this show.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like this is just like the N.K. Jemisin fan hour, you know.
There's nothing wrong with that. I just wanted to throw her in there too, because
yeah, it's, no, for sure.
Topical, but
oh, Victoria says she does a podcast with Roxane Gay. I didn't know that.
Really? I didn't know that.
Cool.
That is super exciting. I love everything Roxane Gay, so how did I not know that? Shame on me.
Yeah, you can go look it up after the show.
Oh, better. Yes. Thank you, Victoria.
We also talk about podcasts a lot on the show, so
I love podcasts.
Me too. All right. So, oh, that reminds me, if you weren't aware, for the viewers and also the guests, the show is syndicated as a podcast. So tonight, like, I'll download the audio and upload it as the audio. So you can do the replay on video, or you can do it via podcast if you prefer to listen that way. So, oh, is it called Here to Slay, Victoria? Cool. That's a cool title too.
I like it.
All right, so I have some not so great news. Houghton, is it Houghton?
It is Houghton.
Yes. Okay, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt has eliminated 525 positions from its educational division, which is about 22% of its workforce. Some of those job eliminations include positions that had already been cut via an early retirement incentive that they offered earlier in the year due to the pandemic. And I didn't include it in the notes, but this is only its educational division. It doesn't affect the, what do they call it? The retail division? Not retail.
Yeah.
It's only educational. It's not the
word that we know.
But words are hard.
Right.
Other cost-saving measures will include a focus on the creation of digital content over print product.
Obviously this is a big downside for everybody that works at Houghton, but losing a lot of the educational division, Houghton is one of the companies, education-wise, that have been able to be competitive in the textbook market. And because they've always had a different kind of point of view, so they're not necessarily beholden to, do the Texas teachers like it? All right, then we're all going to use it. Mm. So, you know, this is actually, you know, it's terrible for the people who had, you know, who are getting, you know, moved out of Houghton anyway, but it's definitely going to have like an echoing effect on the textbooks that kids get, and the points of view that they get in those texts.
That's a good point. I'm glad you're here to bring that context. I have known several people who worked at HMH in the education division, but almost all of them have left over the past couple of years. So I don't have like a connection to that really.
Yeah, it's, you know, because it's not, you know, it's a lot of it is textbooks. Like, you know, anytime mm-hmm. that you have a textbook where it's like, read this excerpt and now answer these six questions. But they also do a lot of direct to classroom books, like, you know, small board books and small paperback books and things like that, that are direct to classrooms, that, you know, again, you know, they've gone out of their way to have a different perspective from some of the pure textbook oriented companies. And so, you know, yeah, that's going to be a loss.
Yeah. All right.
And on that note,
you have even worse news. Oh gosh.
The 2020 winner of the International Publishers Association's Prix Voltaire Prize, Pham Doan Trung, has been arrested in the Vietnamese government for conducting anti-state propaganda and is facing up to 20 years in prison. She is an author, journalist, and co-founded Liberal Publishing House as a direct challenge to the Vietnamese government's control of the publishing industry.
Yeah. Go ahead. I was just going to mention, because I hadn't mentioned it yet, all of the news items that we're talking about today, I'm going to put the links for each of them in the description after the show. And so if you want to read more about it, you can find the link after the show ends. But yeah, reading this one, it's pretty brief little blip. And also, I hadn't really heard a lot of people talking about it on Twitter and that kind of thing. So I wanted to bring it up.
It has not been a super great year for a lot of artists in a lot of different nations. Mm-hmm. You know, they have, shut down all kinds of independent presses in Russia. You know, then you have the bad Disneyfication of the Mulan stuff.
Yes.
That then they're also, you know, we're going to thank the people who are, you know, holding the Uyghurs in concentration camps. Great. And now you have this going. It's been very frightening. You know, free speech has been fairly frightening in the United States for a little while now, but I'm not to the point where I'm afraid like I would get put in jail for the stuff that I say.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That was another reason I wanted to make sure to include this in today's news roundup is, cause we talk about like the issues in publishing, you know, in the United States, and then you see something like this and you remember, you know, what's at stake. You remember like what could be. And and she had pre-recorded a talk for Frankfurt that was on, she called it Guerrilla Publishing, I believe. Yeah, and so they're still going to air that talk. It's next week, right, Frankfurt?
Yes.
It's coming up very soon, yeah.
I think that's fantastic. I'm glad that they've managed to shut her down, but they haven't managed to silence her.
Yeah, she pre-recorded the talk, so they're still going to air it, so that's good.
Great.
All right, so Like Water for Chocolate was released in 1989, but author Laura Esquivel just announced she is working on two sequels and a musical is also in the works. The second book is going to be called Tita's Diary, and it will follow the main character for 20 years that was not included in the original book. And then the third book will take place in present day, featuring a descendant of the De La Garza family who discovers Tita's diary. And I feel like Some people are going to be really excited about this. Some people are going to shrug their shoulders, but I'm very excited about this because I read that book when I was definitely too young to read that book. and I loved it. So, yeah.
See, I'm more familiar with the movie, shame on me. Mm-hmm. But like just reading the way it's like, okay, and there's the second book is going to be 20 extra years. And then the third one is going to be what happens when people read that 20 extra years.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and Stephanie Meyer just put out Edward's version. And in 10 years, we're going to get Carlisle version. And so it's like, it's like Twilight for.
Yeah. Literature.
Sorry.
I'm going to include that in the video highlights, you saying like Water for Chocolate is Twilight for Literature. That's great. So I was reading, I was like, second book, whatever, okay. And then third book, I was like, oh, that would be kind of cool though, is to have like a modern update to the concepts.
And that's one of the nice things about fiction for adults is that you can actually do something like that. If you try to do stuff like that in YA, people get really upset.
I've done
that out the hard way. But yeah. I didn't actually get a chance to read the article. Is the author developing the musical or is someone developing the musical
at the same time? It's someone else. Let me pull it up real quick because like some of the names involved were really interesting. So just give a second to load. Oh gosh, ads. Okay. So the Latin band La Santa Cecilia is writing music and lyrics for it, with one of the writers from In the Heights also working on lyrics.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
And yeah, and Lisa Loomer is writing the book.
Very nice.
And then it's got a nice list. Michael Mayer of Spring Awakening is directing. So
wow.
Might be that is really good.
That's a really exciting slate there.
Yeah. All right, you have our final news item.
Okay, and we're gonna find this. This will be totally relevant to what we end up talking about tonight. Following the UK publication of a letter in support of transgender and non-binary people, signed by more than 200 authors, editors, and agents. YA author Maureen Johnson stepped up to compile a North American version. At the same time, Johnson was criticized when she claimed that the North American author community wasn't here for TERFs, trans-exclusionary radical feminists, with many trans and non-binary authors replying that she's dead wrong about that.
Yeah, I have seen conversation around this.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things. Now, keep in mind, I'm an older queer. And I say that in all sincerity, you know, I grew up in literally a different time. So for me, when, you know, Maureen said, it's like, oh yeah, they're not here for that. As a non-binary person, I was not offended by it. But just because, you know, I know that she's like, what she's really saying is like, this has been a super great turnout. But at the same time, you know, the things that Z.R. Eliot and several other trans authors and non-binary authors have brought up and discussed with Maureen about that, you know, it is important to be precise with our words sometimes, because it's really easy for us to sign a letter, but sometimes it's still really hard to be queer in publishing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm also non-binary, but because it was kind of like there were two conversations happening where some people were saying, no, this letter is bad, actually, which I think is just like reductive and, you know, a little simplistic. I think it becomes bad if people think that signing it is where they need to stop. You know what I mean? Like if they think that's all they have to do. So, yeah. But we're going to provide a link to the letter in the description later tonight as well. The UK letter is going to be in there as well. Cassandra provided that. So signed by Stephen King, Margaret Atwood, Roxane Gay. Those are like kind of the big names that a lot of people have been mentioning.
John Green, basically every YA author you've ever heard.
All right. So, and with that, we get to bring on our special guest for the evening. So, oh, I need a little sound effects. That would be awesome. Or I could just have you on every episode. You could there do that.
Yeah, you don't have to have me on the screen at all. I'll just, you know. Bah, bah, bah.
All right. So T.S. Ferguson joined Jimmy Patterson as an editor in 2019. Prior to that, he worked at Harlequin Teen Inkyard Press for over 7 years, where he worked with New York Times bestselling authors Robin Talley and Hillary Monahan, and critically acclaimed authors such as Adi Alsed, Amy Lukovics, and Will Kostakis, I think. Yeah, cool. I love how other languages are phenetic, even if English is.
I noticed that he's the name out. Right?
Well, this
although,
is from...
Although, to be fair, Uddy's name is pronounced Uddy, even though it's an idiot.
Okay. So. That was from the Jimmy Patterson website. So we're going to talk a little bit more, though, when we bring TS in. So, hey, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to Pub Talk Live.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
All right. I'm just going to have Sandra record all the sound effects. So to kind of get us started off, can you tell us a little bit about your career in publishing, how you got started, the highlights, you know, how you got where you are now, that kind of thing?
Yeah, definitely. I always like to talk about how I went to college because I wanted to be a writer. And then by the time I got to the end of my English degree, I hadn't written a thing. And I thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? You know, now I have an English degree and I don't want to do any of the like kind of generic jobs you can get with like a liberal arts degree. I want to do something with books. And then the idea of reading for a living popped into my head, and I said, I want to be an editor, not knowing that an editor does so much more than reading.
That's kind of like telling a librarian that you're so jealous about how much they get to read, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea. So I ended up moving to New York and going to grad school for publishing, which was just a lot of debt racking up, but it got me some connections and I ended up getting into publishing and had a very focused eye on being an editor. I wanted to be an editor. I didn't want to do any other job in publishing. And I made it happen and started at Little Brown Young Readers in 2006. And as you said, moved over to Harlequin Teen and Inkyard Press for a while. And now I'm back at Hachette as part of Jimmy Patterson.
Cool.
That's been quite a loop-de-loop there.
Yeah, full circle. It was very weird to go back to Hachette 10 years after I left, because half the people I knew, like, they were family, and the other half were completely brand new. but I had a few, like, big-name editors at the company come up to me when I first started and said, like, oh, I remember you. Welcome back. And I got, like, totally starstruck.
Aw.
Yeah.
You said you started there in 2006?
So I started in marketing in 2005 and then moved over to LBYR editorial in 2006.
So you were there for the beginning of Twilight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was there I was in marketing when the first book came out and then moved over and was there until after Breaking Dawn.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Talk about high expectations there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember at one point getting the manuscript for, I think it was Eclipse, from the managing editor and being able to make a copy, because this was when everything was routing hard copy. And I was so excited because I wanted to read it really quickly. And then because, you know, it's so hard to read manuscripts, it sat on my bedroom floor until the book came out and then I read it. And somebody said to me, you know, that's really dangerous. If that had gotten out of your hands, you would have been fired. Like, I had a clandestine copy of this book the entire time.
And then didn't even do anything with it.
Yeah, so I just sat collecting dust.
They like stamp your name on it.
I think so that nowadays they would.
Yeah.
By the time Breaking Dawn came out, they definitely like it was not getting out to anybody.
So, what kind of books do you work on now for Jimmy Patterson?
So, for Jimmy, I like to say that we're really looking for books that have like a really strong hook and like really compelling, compulsive like readability. Jim has this kind of motto for the imprint that he really wants kids to read one of our books and immediately ask for another book. He doesn't want them to kind of feel like, okay, I'm done, now can I go play? He wants to create readers out of kids. So those are really the books we're looking for, is books that will like suck those kids in and have them like begging for more.
That's awesome.
Cool. Yeah. And then on a personal note, I'm always just anything queer. Sandra knows.
Well, and yeah. Well, and the thing is that we've actually talked about this before, that you did not like go into Harlequin being like, I'm going to be the queer book guy. And yet somehow you still managed to get to be the queer book guy. How did that happen?
I think, you know, what's funny is when I was at LBYR, it was still like, I feel like there were not a lot of queer books coming out. And I, as like a new editor who is still unsure of himself, I think bought into that idea that like, oh, you know, you can only have one or two queer books on the list and they're going to be a hard sell. And I worked on IMJ by Chris Beam when I was at LBYR and was just in love with it. And was there when Melinda Lowe's Ash came out and was very jealous that I was not the editor. But I still, I think, had like that thing in the back of my head that, you know, well, it's going to be tough. And I'm going to have to put up a fight. And, you know, as a queer editor myself, I was like, I want to publish these books, but, you know, it might be an uphill battle. And then when I got to Harlequin and started getting submissions, I don't know, it just kind of happened organically. And somewhere along the way, you know, and I think a lot of the conversations on Twitter and, you know, with my authors helped, but I just really flipped and was like, fuck it. I don't know if I can say that. you know, I want to put those books out, because one of the reasons I wanted to be an editor was because books saved my life as a kid, and I really want to do that for kids reading my books. So and you know, and then
I think that's awesome. I know that, yeah, coming up as an author, and I know that I'm a little bit older than you, that for, you know, a large part of my career, it, like, if you wanted to write something queer, you would have to like ask the editor if it was okay. Like if you were going to be part of an anthology, or if you were going to send something to a magazine, it'd be like, would it be okay if I write a queer story? And it was not until, you know, I had already published a couple of YA books that all of a sudden there was queer YA fiction everywhere. And like, it was a huge, you know, it blew my mind, honestly, because, you know, I had that experience coming up as, you know, asking the permission of editors who might sometimes allow me to have a little treat of a little bit of queer in a story.
A little bit of queer for a treat. Yeah.
Yes. Just a little palate refresher.
Well, and I will say, like, I give a lot of credit to Harlequin Teen and to my boss over there, Natasha. You know, they've gotten a lot of flack over the years for some controversial books, but I always felt very supported when I was going after queer books, and also Natasha really trusted me, because I, you know, she had come over from the adult romance side and was, you know, very well studied in YA, but I had come from a kid lit job, so she really trusted me to, you know, have that prior experience and bring that, so I was able to kind of push the boundaries in a way that maybe I wouldn't have at, you know, Harlequin Teen was about 2 years old when I started there. And if I had been at an imprint that had been established and kind of set in their ways, I don't know how much more opportunity I would have gotten. Mm-hmm. But they were very supportive when, you know, I remember when We Need Diverse Books first started, I was very eager to kind of jump on board and support them. And we got a lot of, you know, like in-house, there was a lot of support and conversation. And I was really appreciative of that, because it allowed me to push boundaries. And even in terms of not even just queer stuff, but I published a horror author, and I had a mindset of, I'm just going to let her do, you know, whatever she needs to do to make this a gory or scary horror and not hold her back. And I think a lot of editors are kind of apprehensive because it's for kids to not go too far. And her first, Amy Lukovics is the author that I worked with, and her first book, she like has, you know, dead babies and miscarriages. And I mean, like a whole host of like horrible things happen to her characters. And I said, you know, I love this because you don't hold back. This is what horror is. And Harlequin really let me do that too. So it kind of, I give them a lot of credit for that too. They helped me be, I think, bolder as an editor, as I was growing into my confidence as an editor.
Awesome.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to interject just because I'm curious. So I've been following Sandra on Twitter, there you go, for a while. And then TS and I met at, is it Willamette? I always say it wrong.
Oh, I don't even know. I always say Willamette, but I don't know if that's right.
That's what I said too. And people kept correcting me. So like Willamette Writers Conference in Portland, the year before last. And so I had asked TS to be on the show, and he's like, well, you know, I was asking, who would you like as a guest co-host? And he suggested Sandra. And I was like, I would love that. That would be awesome. But how did you two meet?
Well,
your version.
I mean, like, I guess it's pretty simple. Like, Sandra's anthology got submitted to me. It was exactly the thing that I was looking for. And I immediately jumped at it. I don't know. We made magic together.
We did. Yeah. What's interesting is that the idea for All Out initially was actually my agent, Jim McCarthy's idea. He's also a queer man. And we had bounced back and forth with each other because he thought like maybe he wanted to try and do it, but he didn't have any experience on like that side of doing things. You know, he's a fantastic editorial agent, but like he's never done like an anthology. And I said, you know, Jim, you know, if you want me to, I will be more than happy to, you know, like help walk you through it and, you know, cheerlead. And I, you know, we can do this. And ultimately he decided that he wanted me to do it because he was afraid that it would be like a conflict of interest when it came to contracts and things like that. So mm-hmm. He gave me the baby. But what's interesting is that when we were coming up with the list of editors to send it to, like I knew that there were like a handful. There are a handful of editors I knew that would be interested in doing both anthologies and a queer anthology. But Jim was essentially like, "Well, I'm going to send this to TS because this is going to be catnip," and and so. He sent it off, and we had one editor at one of the big five. There were still five at that point, who wrote back and it's like, well, how do we know all of these people are queer? Because I've looked at some of their websites and some of their websites don't actually say that they're queer.
Oh my God.
And I was like, we can assure you that if they're on the list, they're queer. But then TS came back and he was just like, yes, let's do this now. Yes, yes, yes. You can't beat somebody who actually knows the community, who is part of the community. And that's just it was so special because like I did not have to spend time explaining like certain terminology or why this character was doing this thing that like, you know, heteronormative characters were not going to be doing. It was so nice to be working with people who were just like, who get it. And TS got it from the very beginning.
Yeah. And it, you know, I was so proud that we were putting out that book. And then I think my favorite anecdote, I think, is after the book came out, I started saying to my boss, you know, it would be really great if we did like a follow-up that was contemporary. Cause you know, the first anthology was historical. And I love Sandra had kind of pitched it to me as, you know, people just assume that queer people just appeared out of thin air, but we've been here forever. So like, you know, let's do a historical anthology to say like, we've been here throughout history. So I kept saying to Natasha, you know, it would be really great. We should suggest that she do a contemporary anthology, like a follow-up. And then before I could email Jim, he emailed me and said, Sandra and I have been talking and we want to do a contemporary follow-up. And I think my response to him was, oh my God. and here we are.
That's so fun.
And allegedly, I have heard a rumor that there is a proposal for a future one somewhere out there right now.
What was it we were joking about? If you ever did a future one, we would call it All Outer Space.
Well, I want the tagline, because I do out there, into the queer new yonder.
I love it.
I mean, I don't think we're ever going to beat Queer We Go Again for the second one, but
I feel like there are a lot of just really great space puns that you could make. Yeah.
So you could also just do the future is queer.
Yes.
All right.
I can see queerly now. Yes. So
cool. No,
so how much am I your favorite?
Oh, so much. I mean, literally when Sarah was like, who do you know? I was trying to think, who do I have a great rapport with? Who can we banter with? Who can, you know, we have good conversation with? And you were one of the people that immediately came up, because, you know, I think when we started working together, it was like immediate, like we clicked immediately.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that it's so rare and it's such a pleasure. I mean, which is not to say that, you know, I don't get along with other editors. I mean, there are a couple, but you know, it was just like everything was exactly right. Hey, Laura H., the tour of what I have on my shelves right now is every single book that is being evaluated for the Stonewall Awards this year, because my wife is on the Stonewall Committee.
Nice.
The middle shelf is, these are mine right here, but all of the other ones, all of these books are queer, mostly YA, middle grade, and picture books that have come out this year. So
that's
literally, if it is queer and you have heard of it coming out this year, it is everywhere. It has been such a pleasure this year. I hope that doesn't stop next year. I'll be very sad.
Yeah.
If somebody breaks in and steals all those books, it wasn't me.
I mean, and I have to be honest, I have like 15 of them upstairs right now in my room, so that I can... you know, these are the ones that we've already evaluated. Well, my wife evaluates them. I just read them and enjoy them.
That's more fun, I feel like. All right. So a lot of people are wondering, and I've been getting this question a lot, so I wanted to kind of get your take on it, TS, and Sandra as well. What kind of changes are you seeing in the industry because of the pandemic? And what do you think the lasting effects, especially for writers, will be?
That's a good question. I mean, I definitely will say things feel like they're moving a lot slower, at least on my end. It's been tough for me working from home. I'm an extrovert. I like being around people. I like being able to go to someone's desk and ask them a quick question and not have to schedule a WebEx call for, you know, just a 5-minute conversation. But, you know, I will say, like, it's also, to a large extent, it feels like things are still kind of going forward normally. You know, I'm sure we've taken sales hits. I'm sure everybody has, especially in the beginning. But it sounds like sales-wise, books are starting to come back from, you know, like where we were in March and April. You know, I know acquisitions are still moving forward. I think really, like, and I think, like, it's starting to speed up again. But I think mostly it was just, there was a major slowdown. People are still getting used to, even 6 months into it, working from home, having to schedule digital, you know, like video calls. I will say presenting at sales conference has been interesting, because I don't know, in some ways it's a lot easier because you're on a video, you can just sit at your computer and you have your notes right there and you're not in front of 100 salespeople. But on the other hand, like when you're talking, there's just your face and a slide of your book.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned you're extrovert, because I've been struggling with, I think, probably a lot of the same things. But one of them is when you're having these conversations, whether, so for me, it's like teaching workshops, because that's what my day job is, right? I can't tell how the people are receiving it, which I'm very used to taking those cues and adjusting what I'm doing, you know, in response to people's reactions. And you just can't do that on Zoom. And so it's been draining.
Yeah. We're doing we're transitioning Hachette to a new title information system right now, which has been going on since before I started with the company, but I'm the Jimmy lead person for the editorial team. So basically I was like thrust into this role of like training. I mean, my team is three people, but we got paired up with LBYR. So it's me and the LBYR leads training the entire editorial department. And it's really interesting because I'm a theater kid. So I can get up in front of people and, you know, I'll get nervous, but the minute I'm in front of people, I'm kind of on. Doing it digitally, it's so different because you don't see everybody's faces. You can't play off of people. I mean, I was so nervous last week doing my first training that I was planning my shtick while the other person was presenting. Because I was like, well, I can't do this off the cuff because I can't feel the audience's energy at all. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of that. And like sales conference, I think, is the same way. It's a lot better when it's like one-on-one or like just a couple people, because you can put your video on, you can see people's faces. But the bigger meetings have been really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. As an author, it's hard to be creative right now, just in general, but one of the things that's been really difficult for me and for a lot of other authors is like, what the hell do we do about COVID in our books? I had put together a partial, which is, in my case, it was 25 pages, for my agent and my editor to look at, to see like, you know, if they wanted to develop in that way or if we wanted to do something else. And I had submitted it last year, like last spring. And then there were other things that were due that I had to do before that I could get back to that. And, you know, they had given me notes and I was going to work on it when I had a chance to work on it, and then COVID. And so even though, you know, it's paranormal set in the modern world, it's like, so what do I do now? I mean, do they go to school? You know, do I need to put in masks and hand sanitizer? Do I, you know, can they kiss? Because, you know, like watching stuff that's on television now, and it's just so weird to see people so close to each other. And I finally wrote to Jim, my agent Jim, and I was like, I don't understand what I do with COVID. And he said, yeah, you know what? Nobody understands what to do with COVID. So if I were you, I'd keep writing it as if COVID hadn't happened. And if it needs to be changed after it's acquired, then we'll change it.
Yeah, I've had similar conversations. Yeah, with my writers group and stuff.
Have you?
Yeah, well, because I had one book that is complete, and I am finishing up revisions on it for my agent. That's a contemporary. It takes place in like a mid-sized town in Pennsylvania, in a high school, very heavily reliant on like being in school, you know? And so I was like, I'm not going to do anything for that one. I'm just going to leave that how it is, because it's written, you know, it's almost done. But then the one I was drafting, it takes place in a very small town in Texas. And I knew that one of my main characters, her parents had just moved to this town. And so I use that as the reason, like that their jobs changed or whatever, because of COVID. And one of my friends in my writing group, it's like an alpha reader group, like they read it as we go along. She's an editor, and she was like, oh, there it is. And I was like, that's it. That's literally the only thing I'm putting in the entire book about it. Because I was like, they live in a small town in Texas anyway. Like, they don't even believe coronavirus exists. So it's fine.
Yeah, I feel like as a reader, I see the comment from Victoria. Yeah. I feel the same way. I'm like, let's just pretend COVID doesn't exist. I mean, not in real life.
We're the weird one because I have seen several authors talking about books that came out this year, which obviously were written 2 years ago. And like they're getting dinged on Goodreads and on the Amazon reviews and stuff like that because it's like, it's 2020. What about COVID? And it's like, sorry, I didn't have my magic ball. But yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, we have authors who are actually taking flack because they did not predict COVID, you know, when they.
I think that's just a handful of people, though. Like, that's not definitely not the majority.
I love the responses to those reviews, though, because they're so sarcastic. You know, like, how dare this author not be psychic and predict?
Yeah. It's, like it's the only time that you can make fun of a reviewer and not get in trouble.
Like, maybe I'll switch back to fantasy for a little while until everyone figures out what's going on.
I'm like, yeah, right. So.
Yeah.
It's been a very weird year.
Yeah. All right. So we have just one more question for you, TS. I'm going to, I forgot. Remember when I was like, is there anything else? And I was like, trying to think, I feel like I'm forgetting something. This is what I was forgetting. I always like to give the guests a little heads up about this question. So you're getting it cold. So congrats. Right. So this question is phrased very deliberately. What is the most important book you've read and why?
Oh God. I'm no like, pressure. Yeah, let's do that cold. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I give a heads up.
I mean, I guess I have a follow-up question. Important to me or important kind of?
Yeah, either. So just like define it however you want. So some people, yeah.
I mean, I always go, and this is kind of my answer to like what my favorite book is too. I always go back to the Wonderful Wizard of Oz. That was the book that, so I grew up with kind of a dad who was abusive and was going through a lot of his own stuff when I was little. But one of the great memories I have is him reading me The Wizard of Oz. And it was kind of the book that I learned to read on. So like he started reading it to me and by the time we were done, I was reading it. And that's just basically been my favorite book and the most important book. I think that's the kind of catalyst for everything that I've become in my life. The movie was one of my favorite movies growing up as well. And when I was in getting my master's for publishing, my thesis was on the original publication of the book. And, you know, and it was just always that book that it was like my passion, my like publishing passion book. So I'd say that's probably my answer.
Aww,
that's great.
I don't know if I could answer it if it was the most important book
for the world.
Yeah. But personally that was a Wizard for sure.
Awesome. That's a good answer.
Yeah. And actually the thesis that I wrote on The Wizard of Oz helped me get my first job as a Kidlet editor because I had it on my resume and they said it was like one of the signs that I was passionate about children's books. So it attracted them.
Aww.
Yeah.
Cool. Very nice.
So you're a friend of Dorothy in many ways.
I am. Yes. And I played the Tin Woodman in the musical when I was in.
Oh, that's fun.
I was very upset that I wasn't the Scarecrow, but to be fair, I was kind of stiff on stage back then, so it worked out. I haven't come out yet, so I was a little nervous.
Oh, yeah. I was Ebony, who's one of our regulars. She must not be watching today because she always comments on the faces people make when I ask that question. So,
have you ever gone through and just like collected the screenshots?
That's a good idea. I've thought about just doing a cut of all the answers together.
Oh, that would be good too. That would actually be substantive, you know.
The faces would be good too, though. I like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
All right, TS, thank you so much for coming on today. I'm so glad we could make it work. Everyone's busy right now. So every time someone agrees to be on the show, I'm just like excited and happy. Thank you. And you can find TS's Twitter and some other information. I can't remember exactly what to put in the description down below. Oh, it's your MSWL post. Check out TS on Twitter, and thank you for joining us. And Sandra and I are just going to close out a couple of things.
Awesome. Thank you for having
me. Thank you for bringing me in.
Of course.
Nice. All right. So we don't have a whole bunch left for you today. So I didn't do a quote of the week. So like I said, this is the second year of Pub Talk Live. And when I started, I chose a year of quotes. And then I haven't chosen any new ones. So if you like the quote and you want me to continue doing those, let me know. And if not, that's fine. I won't be offended either way. So yeah. And then also we usually do an audiobook of the week. I am once again, a judge for the Audi Awards. So all of my listening time is going to that. And so I won't be able, and I'm not allowed to talk about the books that I'm listening to for that. So, Lodestar has a quote for us. Okay. Go ahead and share it, Lodestar. So I don't have an audiobook for you, and I probably won't for the rest of the year unless something weird happens and I just need a break from judging. Have you listened to any, do you listen to audiobooks, Sandra?
I do. Okay. I'll tell you what, the last two audiobooks that they knocked me off my socks. And I feel bad because I don't have the voice actors' names in front of me. But the voice actor for Justina Ireland's Dread Nation is incredible. Like,
I wonder who it is.
It was so immersive and so expressive. And just, I mean, I had read the book before I listened to the audiobook. I was just kind of curious.
Oh, and it's Bonnie Turpin. That's why. Bonnie Turpin is one of the best narrators in the business. Yeah. She's amazing.
Listening to it made it like a whole new book. And she was so fantastic. And then the most recent one that I've listened to was, and again, I'm sorry, I don't know the voice actor's name, was the audiobook for Leah Johnson's You Should See Me in a Crown, which she... Leah is another Indiana author, and this particular book is about a girl who ends up having to run for prom queen so that she can try and get a scholarship. And you know, it's a queer girl in Indiana, and it's prom, and it's very exciting. And her voice is just, both Leah and the voice actors, just so bright. And I mean, it's like lemonade in summer when it's really, really hot. I've thoroughly enjoyed listening to it.
That's great. Alaska Johnson, TS has put it in the chat. Alaska Jackson, sorry, is the narrator for that. I don't know that narrator, and I haven't listened to that one, so I'll definitely check that out. Bonnie Turpin is like one of my favorite narrators in the business. She's so good. And I have like a very short list of narrators that even if I'm not interested in the book itself, if they narrate it, I'll probably listen to it anyway because I love their work. Yeah. So it's like Kim My Guest, Emily Wuzeller, the girl who did Roshni's books is really good too.
Her voice is so great.
Yeah. I can't remember her name right now, but yeah.
Like some voice actors, it bugs me when they do different voices, and then there are other ones who like are just so comfortable in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That then I can really enjoy it. So So those are two that I've really enjoyed lately.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. So Lodestar has a quote for us. You need chaos in your soul to give birth to a dancing star. Nietzsche. I've heard that one before. Thanks for sharing.
I have not. That's a good one.
I love quotes. That's the whole reason why I had a quote of the week, is just because I like them.
I like making them up. I tell people that, you know, oh no, I read this in this very obscure book. I just like making them up.
That's funny. So Jay asked what platforms to use for audiobooks. A lot of them I get sent by the publisher because I write for Book Riot. So they just send me the files. And so I using like a music app. But when I buy them, I buy from Libro FM, which supports indie bookstores. And Libro FM has any book that Amazon would have except for Amazon exclusives. and their software is just as good, and you're supporting indie bookstores too.
And then I also
like, go ahead. 100% get all of my audiobooks from the library.
That's what's going to be my, yeah, I get mine from the library too.
Like some of them you can listen to in Libby, some of them you listen to in Overdrive and stuff like that. But yeah, it's, I love the library.
Yeah, I get mine from the books from, because they have, it's Hoopla is the, so Overdrive and Libby are like the same company basically. And then Hoopla, and there are a couple others, but most of them are in Overdrive or Libby. So yeah. And I work at a library. So if there's not a book in there that I want to listen to, I just like yell at an acquisitions librarian. And most of the time it works.
That works out well.
They don't always give me what I want, but most of the time. All right. So we're going to talk about the viewer poll before we say goodbye. Oh, yeah. And yeah, so let me switch the screen over to that. All right. So the question was, there it is. Do you tend to write the best or most in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, or pretty much any time? And I am surprised to see that 50% said in the evening, about 27% said in the morning, 15% in the afternoon, and 8.5% said pretty much any time.
Now, I will admit that when I answered it, I said in the evening, even though... Yeah. That's not true anymore. Oh. What did you say?
Well, I can't vote because I created it, but I'm definitely a night person. My most like creative time is kind of like 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. usually. Mm-hmm. But that's on the schedule that I'm on right now. So like I have delayed sleep phase syndrome. So if I didn't have to be at work every day at 9, my sleep schedule would be very different, and so maybe my writing schedule would be different. But yeah, I'm a night owl through and through. So
that's how I started out, as I, you know, had to be nighttime plus a whole bunch of other dumb stuff. But you know, once I had kids, over time I had to like start getting rid of like the rich, like, okay, well, I'm not going to sit down and burn candles because what, you know, and so it got to the point where it's like, as long as I can't hear SpongeBob in the next room, I can work.
Mm-hmm.
But I would still greatly prefer to be working overnight if I were just allowed to have whatever schedule I wanted.
Yeah. Heather said she's a morning writer. Duffy said, I'm not a morning person. I'm not a morning person either. Lodestar is a morning person. Eat the frog. I don't know that one. Method. Yeah. You'll have to tell me more about that later, Jay. And Heather said, I'm useless in the morning. So I'm the opposite. Like, because, you know, you see this like hashtag 5 a.m. writers club and stuff, right? And my response is, the only way I'm writing 5 a.m. is if I'm still writing from the night before.
Exactly.
I'm not getting up at 5 a.m. to write. Sorry.
That is, yes. Oh, no.
But when I do writers retreats and that kind of thing, I do write in the afternoon as well. So. Yeah.
You have to, because if you don't, then you can't like socialize. For, yeah. Everybody wants to have, that's when they have the quiet hours. And it's like, oh, all right then.
Yeah. Oh, eat the frog means. Go ahead.
Oh, now that my youngest is 18 and like she has a job and stuff like that, I'm now like, I could have that sleep schedule again.
Yeah. I had a conversation the other day. Someone had asked me, you know, what my writing rituals were, like what, you know, what, when was I most productive? How do I like to write, that kind of thing? And I had realized a couple of years ago that I was kind of falling into that, that you were talking about, where you have to have, you know, a candle burning, you have to have like everything perfect. You have to have, the sound has to be right, everything like that. And I realized that that's a trap. I feel
like,
yeah, because if you find yourself in a position where you can't have that perfect setting, and then you're not able to write, or at least you're basically telling yourself, I'm not able to write unless this is a perfect setup. That's something like I heard Jonathan Mayberry talk about once before, and he'll write anywhere. He writes on the plane. Like, who writes on the plane?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
You know,
I've been, I've been doing.
So I try to be as flexible as I can.
I was at a conference with Jonathan Mayberry, and they were having a drink and greet after the whole day's programming, which like the authors were supposed to make themselves available, like in the bar area in the hotel. And he was in the middle of like this big, the bar, everybody was talking, everybody was drinking, and he was also writing.
Just... Who was that?
Jonathan. Jonathan Mayberry.
That doesn't surprise me at all though.
No, yeah. And the thing is, I do want to say that I think for younger, like, when you're a younger author, I think sometimes that those special rituals of like, I have my playlist, I have my drink, I have my, that's one of the only ways that we can really wrap our heads around just honoring the time that we need to write. And so like, especially when, you know, you're pre-published or you're getting mm-hmm. started and like the people in your house are like, what are you doing? And it's yeah. like, okay, if the lights are off and I have my special music and I have my special candle, then I'm working.
Yeah.
And I, you know, now it's to the point where if somebody comes in when I'm working, I will just be obnoxious to them and say, get out, I'm working.
Nice. Yeah.
But, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years now. So, you know, honor your time until you get mean enough to just tell people to go away.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Well, because like before this, I love writing in cafes and, you know, Panera, whatever. And like, I'm an extrovert, like being around people gives me energy. And so to be around people who I'm writing is ideal for me. And obviously that's hasn't been an option for, you know, 7 months. So, yeah. Okay, so I don't definitely want. Yeah.
So like you, because I know tons and tons of authors like you who like to go to the cafe to write. And like, I've tried the cafe, I've tried the library, and I just feel like I'm exposing myself. I mean, like, I may as well just take off my clothes and sit there naked while people walk around behind me while I try to write. And so
that's funny.
I always kind of wondered, but saying that you're an introvert, that makes so much more sense to me now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess not everyone has to be an extrovert to enjoy writing in the cafe, but all right. Well, we are out of time. Sandra, thank you so much for joining me today. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you so much for having me in.
I feel like we had a really great conversation today. We should do a podcast together.
We do. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So thank you, Sandra. Yeah. The Sandra's website and Twitter and Instagram is linked in the description. So go ahead and check them out. And I'll just close this out with a couple messages. Yeah, check out the books too. You have like over 20 books too. So not just those. But
I do. But these are the ones that TS made happen. So
okay. Tie in. Yeah, nice. All right. Exactly. Well, thank you. And I'm just going to close this out. Thank you everyone for tuning in today. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss another episode. Also tell your friends because that is how people find out about things like this. You can also, again, sign up for the email reminder in the description, and you can also check out the Patreon in the description. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. I really appreciate your support and the group and whenever y'all submit questions, it's really fun. So thank you for that. The social media guests for the guests is in the description, like I mentioned, along with Pub Talk Live information. And I just want to let you know about a couple things we have coming up. As every Wednesday, we have the Wednesday write-in at 8 p.m. That is happening every Wednesday for as long as I'm able to keep doing them. I'm also teaching a workshop for free expressions on pitching your book that's going to cover elevator pitches, query synopsis, and comp titles on October 15th. So on Thursday. So if you want to check that out, I'm dropping the link down there. And then on October 17th, I have Agent Chat Live with Matt Belford at Tobias Literary. And that is already scheduled on the channel. So you can go check out more information about that. So thank you all so much for watching. Hopefully we'll see you next time. Everyone stay safe, wash your hands, and wear a mask. And we'll see you next time. Bye.